Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Therapists in the Wild. Today, we're going to be having a conversation about self-compassion.
The themes from this episode are going to draw on the work of Dr. Kristen Neff. She's a psychologist whose work we really love and have been researching. And she's one of the world's leading experts on self-compassion, what it is, how to practice it. So if you like what you hear in this episode, you can feel free to visit her website at self-compassion.org. There are a lot of great practices on there and information that you can learn from. We're also going to have a link in our episode description to her work.
Yes. There's a ton of great stuff on her website. Highly recommend going and checking it out. We decided to do this episode for a few different reasons. One of which is that it's something we struggle with. It's definitely something that is a challenge for both of us. And I think it's something that we've seen a lot of our clients struggle with.
Yeah. And related to that, as we've been, you know, researching Dr. Neff's work, we've been thinking about how there's a lot of overlap with DBT, with the, you know, with kind of the fundamentals of DBT, the role that shame plays in a lot of the problems that clients present to DBT with, and also that a lot of DBT skills that we've already covered on this podcast could be really helpful when both acknowledging the ways that we are not practicing self-compassion and then, you know, using opposite action to practice self-compassion. So maybe before we get into it, we could just mention some of the DBT skills that we're going to be covering today, whether directly or indirectly, so that you can be thinking of them as we, you know, as we talk about this.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think like you just said, opposite action is a big one. I think for a lot of people, when you experience shame, practicing self-compassion is an opposite action. Yes. It's pretty much kind of the opposite of beating yourself up and criticizing yourself for what you think you did wrong. Yeah. And I would say also like a lot of the DBT mindfulness skills, like practicing being non-judgmental, practicing being effective. I think both of those definitely coincide with self-compassion.
Absolutely. And then just kind of bringing it back to the basics, you know, as we have always said on this podcast, the first step is just labeling the emotion, right? So that's the mindfulness of emotion skill. You know, I think for me, a big part of recognizing, you know, when I'm beating myself up and trying to take steps to rectify that is when I just recognize that I'm feeling ashamed, you know, and that in itself, I feel like is kind of an intervention to just say, all right, I'm feeling ashamed right now. What does that feel like in my body? What are the thoughts that are going through my head? And then what can I do about it?
Yes, I'm noticing the feeling of shame in my body. Like that alone just kind of gives you a little bit of distance from the emotion.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is basically the practice of getting into wise mind, and wise mind is going to come up a lot in this episode. And yes, it's hard to practice self-compassion if you are not in wise mind. So that's kind of an anchoring theme here, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And what I've noticed recently, I've been really trying to focus on self-compassion in my own life recently. And something that I have observed is that when I'm in emotion mind, it's sometimes really hard to get into wise mind, even if you know, like, okay, I'm in emotion mind right now. I'm not in wise mind. It would be helpful to be in wise mind, but I'm not sure how to get there. Self-compassion for me recently, at least, has been almost like a tool or a vehicle to get into wise mind. It's like by practicing self-compassion, then I find myself like remembering like, okay, I'm there. Like it just kind of brings you right back to yourself.
That's so true. It would be hard. It would be hard to both be practicing self-compassion and be in emotion mind. Like the very act of doing some of the strategies that we're going to talk about later, you know, being kind to yourself, giving yourself a hug or physical touch, you know, telling yourself it's okay, being a friend to yourself, like that is incompatible with being an emotion mind. You kind of are automatically coming from a place of wise mind. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about what self-compassion is, just to define it, so we're all on the same page.
Okay. So Molly and I actually recently learned how to define this for ourselves. The word compassion literally means to suffer with. And so if you're being self-compassionate, that means you are feeling moved by your own suffering in a way that allows you to respond to your own pain with kindness and understanding.
Right, exactly. And it's kind of like being just a really good friend to yourself, treating yourself the same way that you would treat somebody that you really, really love when you're having a hard time, when you fail, when you notice something that you maybe don't like about yourself. Instead of just criticizing yourself and judging yourself for all those things, self-compassion would involve just kind of stopping and acknowledging that, like, this is really difficult, what I'm dealing with right now. This is a moment of suffering. And how can I kind of comfort myself? How can I care for myself in this moment rather than expecting perfection?
Have you ever done that? I mean, have you ever taken a moment of suffering after you've maybe acted in a way that you regret and taken it as an opportunity to, you know, be moved by your own suffering, to try to reframe the self-judgments and criticism in a way that, you know, acknowledges that you need to comfort yourself, care for yourself, be your own best friend? I mean, I just want to point out how hard that is. It's almost like laughable to think about doing that, you know, with regularity. It's so not how we were conditioned, I think, to think about our own mistakes or our own, you know, ways that we've acted that we wish had gone differently.
I agree. And I think, like you said, it's our learning history has not reinforced this. Like, many of us, you know, grew up in families where, yeah, you do something wrong, you get in trouble. Like, and so that's kind of the way that we tend to, like, parent ourselves or respond to ourselves when we feel like we do something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that I think about self-compassion is that it's a skill, just like any of these other DBT skills that we're working on, where the first time you practice it, it feels kind of weird and unnatural. And like, it takes a lot of effort because you're not used to practicing it and you might not remember to practice it. Mm-hmm. But if you kind of like commit to it and practice it, you know, whenever you notice that you're being really hard on yourself or whenever you're aware of that feeling of shame and just try to be a little kinder to yourself, I think it gets easier, kind of just like any of the other skills.
I love that. I think that's so important and similar to practicing any other skill, whether it's a DBT skill or another type of, you know, therapy skill, rewarding yourself for doing it, right? Just the acknowledgement, like, oh, cool, I just did something different here. Normally I would beat up on myself until I, you know, fall asleep from exhaustion and then wake up the next day feeling just as bad. Instead, I took a different road here. Like, let me congratulate myself for that, because this isn't easy. I think that's so important when you're starting this practice.
I agree. And can I share a recent situation where I did this, where I did exactly what we're talking about?
Please.
So a couple weeks ago, I was working with a client on teaching them mindfulness skills to help with some anxiety that they were dealing with. And I thought it was going fine. And the client was kind of responding well to the mindfulness skills. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, the client gave me the feedback that they really didn't like mindfulness and that they didn't really like the way that we were going about, you know, working with their issue. Mm-hmm. And the way that that feedback was given caused me to feel feelings of shame. And then when I went home that night, I noticed that I was like criticizing myself, beating myself up. Like, I should have noticed sooner that the client wasn't into the mindfulness skills. Like, I should have thought of a better approach to deal with this, so that I wouldn't have to feel the shame right now. And like, really just going over, ruminating in my head, like, what did I do wrong? You got to figure out what you did wrong, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then partially because we were preparing for this episode, I was like, okay, this is a moment where self-compassion would really be helpful. And I'm not practicing self-compassion at all to myself right now. And this isn't really helping me. And I just like took a second, put my hand on my heart and said, like, this is really hard. Like, it's, you really feel right now like this is your fault, like you didn't do a good job. But the truth is that like, therapists make mistakes. You know, you can't always know what's going to be best for every client. And all you can do is like learn from this and try to, you know, change your strategy to make it more helpful to the client. And this is just something that happens. Like, what can we do to, how can we take care of ourselves?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was a game changer.
That's such a game changer. We'll talk in a few minutes, step by step, about why that is a much more effective approach than just beating yourself up, not only for you, but also for this client and all future clients, right?
Yes.
And I just want to share my experience of hearing this story, not only right now, but also when it happened, because of course, you know, you called me and we talked about it. And I just want to share that, you know, when you hear about your friend going through something like this, you're so much kinder. Most of us are so much kinder to our friends than we are to ourselves. You know, I heard that story and I thought, wow, Molly, sounds like a tough day at work. I'm sorry that that happened. That sounds like a tough interaction. You know, sounds like maybe in the next session, a different approach could be used. And yeah, sorry that happened to you. Mm-hmm. Right? My reaction is not to think about all of the ways in which you messed up and you're terrible and you're the worst, right? Like, of course. Right.
You're never going to be able to help any of your clients ever again.
Yeah. Those thoughts would never cross my mind. But then of course, similarly, when something like this happens to me, I do the exact same thing, right? Where I really beat up on myself. So I think it's just important to point that out, that one of the ways to practice self-compassion is to take the perspective of a caring friend, right? And that one way to do that is to actually think about how you react when you hear your friend's stories like this, because it's just true that we tend to not be as hard on other people that we care about as we do on ourselves.
I think that's really true. I mean, I've talked to people about the way that they talk to themselves in their heads. And some people are like, I would get a restraining order against myself. Like, I would be like in jail. Like, it would be, it's just unacceptable, you know, the ways that we talk to ourselves. Like, you wouldn't tolerate that from anybody else.
So let's talk about why, right? Because if we talk to ourselves in such a way that we would need a restraining order against ourselves. I love that example. Why do we do that, right? There must be a purpose. So what do we think?
Well, I know what the research says is that the number one block or barrier to practicing self-compassion is the belief that we must be hard on ourselves and we must criticize ourselves if we want to grow, change, meet our goals. People are worried that they're not going to get anything done and they're not going to be able to keep improving if they don't beat themselves up. Do you feel like that ever?
Yes. For some reason, as you were talking, I was thinking about playing sports as a little kid, which is kind of interesting because I rarely played sports. Although I did sometimes. And I do feel like a lot of the messaging that you get as a kid is about self-improvement, is about like, acknowledge your mistakes, think about what you did wrong and improve. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I ever had a coach or a gym teacher or, you know, whatever that said to me, like, you're the worst person for doing that and therefore you must change. But for whatever reason, I kind of internalize that message of like, okay, I need to know what I did wrong immediately and get better.
Right. And partially, probably it's like, at least I know when I played sports when I was younger, and like we've talked about this before, I don't think either of us were the most athletic children. Like it's embarrassing, right? Like you're playing a sport in front of a bunch of people, there are parents watching. And if you make a mistake, you're like, oof, like that was embarrassing. How do I not feel that again? You're trying to prevent that feeling from happening again. And you think that the best way for you to do that is to like scrutinize your own behavior until you can figure it out, you know, what it was that you did that caused you to end up feeling embarrassed.
That's such a good point. And, you know, I think there is a fine line because it is important to acknowledge your role in conflict, in, you know, in work, in whatever the situation may be. You know, I think that we are taught to acknowledge when we've made a mistake, when we've said something that, you know, didn't have the intended impact, all of that. And like, I think that that's really, really important. And we're not saying don't acknowledge the ways in which you could have acted differently or done better, right? And there's a dialectic here, right? Because often I think we do that as a way of beating ourselves up. I think something that interferes with practicing self-compassion is that voice inside your head that says that if you practice it, you're kind of letting yourself off the hook, right? That you're not acknowledging your role in a conflict or a mistake that you might have made. And, you know, that's something that I definitely struggle with, because I always want to acknowledge, you know, what I could have done better or differently. And I mean, you and I certainly know people who tend to get really defensive and don't acknowledge their role, you know, in making situations worse, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think that I agree that, like, even when I was first learning about self-compassion, this was one of the skepticisms that I had, like, okay, is practicing self-compassion just mean that I'm letting myself off the hook, that I'm not, you know, gonna keep improving as a person, and that I'm also not gonna take responsibility for the things I've done in the past that were wrong. But I think it's interesting that, like, what the research has shown is that people who tend to be more self-compassionate actually take more responsibility for their mistakes and are more likely to apologize than people who are less self-compassionate.
Wow. I mean, that is a huge finding. And I think this is where dialectical thinking comes into play, that you can both acknowledge, you know, what you wish you had done differently, or what you, or a mistake that you made, and practice compassion toward yourself at the same time.
Right. And those things are not mutually exclusive. Like, it's kind of like taking that kernel of truth from that like critical self-talk and rephrasing it in a kind way. So like, you know, for my example, like, if I'm beating myself up about, like, I should have known that the client, that mindfulness wasn't going to be a strategy that would be helpful for this client, right? Like, okay, maybe there's a kinder way that I can rephrase that while still learning from that experience.
And it's interesting, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking that you sitting there beating yourself up is actually preventing you from learning from the situation, right? And this is probably what the research is saying about how people who practice self-compassion are actually more likely to effectively apologize. You know, I can think of an example where I, you know, wronged a friend in the past, and I spent so much time ruminating about it, so much time beating myself up, but I didn't actually effectively apologize, because I was so consumed with myself that it actually prevented me from thinking about the other person and their experience. And that is not being a good friend. That is being someone who, you know, beats themselves up at the expense of actually making things better.
That's a really good point. So I definitely can relate to that, of like times when I felt shame, and that has actually made it difficult for me to put myself in somebody else's shoes. Like, I think shame makes you so focused on your own experience that you can't even step into the other person's shoes and be like, okay, let me think about how I must have hurt this person. And then let me try to repair that damage. Like,
so what you're basically saying is that shame can block problem solving, because it becomes such an inward focused experience that you're actually not doing anything about the situation.
I think it can block problem solving and also compassion to other people. I don't know about you, but for me, like, when I'm feeling really like consumed with shame, like, I'm not really thinking about, I don't really have that much space in my heart to be feeling compassion for other people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think shame presents itself in different ways. And for some people who maybe struggle with self-compassion, shame can present as, you know, ruminating about all the things you did wrong and beating yourself up. And, you know, that can almost be an avoidance of just feeling the shame and then moving on and doing something about it. I think for mm-hmm. other people, when they feel shame, they can try to avoid it by getting really defensive, you know, as we were talking about earlier, and thinking about everyone else's role in the, you know, in the situation. Anger as a secondary emotion. Exactly. And so we're not saying to do that. We're not saying that instead of beating yourself up, you should get really angry at everyone else. And I think what we are saying is that both types of rumination, whether it's ruminating about how terribly everyone else behaved or ruminating about how terribly you behaved, both function to avoid shame. And instead, if you could just experience that shame, practice some self-compassion, and then, you know, solve the problem, that would actually be a much more effective approach.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of what you're talking about, Liza, are some of the benefits of self-compassion, actually. Like actually experiencing the emotion, because it doesn't feel so overwhelming. Like, you can actually learn from your mistakes. You can take responsibility, you know, rather than feeling so ashamed that you either are so focused on beating yourself up or on attacking or criticizing the other person. This is a way for you to actually mindfully open up to and experience the emotion that you're having, and then think about what would be the most effective way to respond, practicing that effectiveness skill.
Yeah, I know we've talked about this in the past on this podcast about why shame, overwhelming shame, can block effective action. And I think it would be worth talking about again here, because really what we're talking about with self-compassion, with what blocks, you know, the ability to practice self-compassion, is overwhelming shame and, you know, how it can be paralyzing. So can we maybe give some examples from our own lives about paralyzing shame and how it prevents us from acting effectively?
Yes. I know that I've had supervision, like clinical supervision, with different types of supervisors, some of whom are very compassionate and, you know, present feedback in a very thoughtful way that considers your feelings, and other supervisors who are very critical and kind of shaming. Mm-hmm. And I know that for me, when a supervisor presents something in a very shaming way, I'm not actually able to learn from it. And it's hard for me to make space for the actually helpful kernel of truth in their feedback that they're giving me.
Hmm. Yep. So shame kind of blocks learning, is what you're saying. I can totally relate to that. Yeah. What something we were actually just talking about before recording is that there have been times in our professional lives when we've avoided learning a new skill as a therapist. Yes. Because it might make us feel ashamed that we didn't already know it in the past.
Uh-huh.
And that we could have been more effective had we known that skill. So let's just not learn it so that we don't need to confront that, you know, that shame.
Feeling.
Self-criticism, which
is
totally antithetical to self-improvement and providing the best care that we can, which are obviously values of ours. So.
Yeah, even saying that out loud, I feel shame about the fact that I've done that. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think it is understandable that it's like learning new things brings up sometimes automatic thoughts of like, well, I should have already known that. Or if I had known that, then I would have done something differently in the past. And that can be really uncomfortable. So I definitely have done that too. Like, I've avoided listening to like educational podcasts, you know, maybe podcasts like this one, you know, where I could actually learn something and become a better therapist or, you know, a better person in certain areas of my life, where I'm like, no, I'd rather listen to something else. So I don't have to think about what I didn't know that I think I should have known.
So true. I also think shame can prevent us from getting the help that we need from other people. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a situation where something happened at work that made me feel really ashamed. And so I wanted to just not talk about it because talking about it made me feel bad about myself, or, you know, like I hadn't handled the situation well.
Mm-hmm.
And instead I was, you know, feeling skillful in that moment. I acknowledged that I felt ashamed. I sat there with my shame. I let it pass. Mm-hmm. And then I used extreme opposite action to actually talk to one of my coworkers about it and say, like, hey, this thing happened. I don't feel great about it. I don't know what to do. And then the coworker gave me advice. And I actually remember her saying to me, like, I'm really glad you told me. That must have been hard to,
wow,
to voice that out loud. And when we just sit with these things on our own, that's not good, right? Like, it prevents us from actually solving the problem, from feeling better. And so, like, good for you for sharing that. And
wow.
It, yeah.
And I'm curious with that example, Liza, like, do you feel like self-compassion played a role in that, in allowing you to bring that up with your coworker?
Yes. I think self-compassion played a critical role, because I think to even acknowledge that I needed help took some self-compassion, right? I had to think about the situation. I had to acknowledge that I felt ashamed. And then I had to say, like, yeah, this is something you're struggling with that you need help with.
Yes. And there's not something wrong with you for struggling. Like, mm-hmm. I think that is a big part of self-compassion, is that it's, nobody's perfect. It's unrealistic to expect yourself to be perfect. Everybody struggles. Everybody has stuff that they could improve on. Everybody has stuff that they, you know, do sometimes that they could have done better or would have liked to do better. And that's just a normal part of the human experience. Yeah. So, like, making space for that probably made you feel more comfortable or more open to sharing this with someone, because you're not automatically assuming that that means that there's something wrong with you and that you're exposing that to the other person.
Yeah. And, you know, this kind of makes me think of another benefit of practicing self-compassion, which is connecting with other people, right? Because when I went to my coworker and said, hey, like, this thing happened, can I get your support? I would assume that made her feel closer to me, and that made her feel like I was a real person who, you know, had an issue, who was seeking her advice, which probably made her feel flattered, right? And it actually made us closer as, you know, as coworkers.
I think that's a great point. Like, I don't typically find myself drawn to people who present as perfect.
Me neither.
I tend to feel more comfortable connecting with people who are open and vulnerable about the things that they feel like they could improve on, or their shortcomings or failures or things like that. And then being able to talk with them, like our friendship, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like we've done that from the beginning. And that's something that's really helped us connect, being open about the things that we feel ashamed about, or the things that we feel like we could have done differently. And it does definitely deepen connection to do that.
Yeah. So it almost makes me think that that's a step of practicing this, right? That the first step is acknowledging the shame. The second step is practicing self-compassion, right? Telling yourself that it's okay, acting as a friend toward yourself. The next step is, you know, thinking about potentially how to solve the problem or how to use opposite action. To better yourself or the situation. And then maybe the last step is sharing it with someone. Maybe that's like the most extreme form of opposite action with this, right?
Yes. Well, I think that's true for if it's shame specifically, which I guess is typically when self-compassion is most needed, the action urge associated with shame is to hide, because you feel like you're going to be rejected from another person or from a group if the thing that you're ashamed about is exposed. And that serves, we've talked about this before in the podcast, but that really serves an evolutionary function of staying connected to the group. That's when we were all cave people, like that's what kept us alive. Wow. So it's, you know, it was important to hide certain things so that you wouldn't get left behind and get rejected and die maybe, you know? So it truly is kind of the ultimate opposite action to shame, to expose those things about yourself that you fear would lead other people to reject you or abandon you. And then to have that experience, it's almost like an exposure, really.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about how self-compassion can help with shame and the ways in which shame, you know, blocks us from action, blocks us from connecting with people. I want to talk about a different type of self-compassion for a moment and because I don't think that it's only helpful when we're feeling shame. I think that in general, self-compassion is helpful when we can't control situations as well. Like when we need to be accepting and when there's nothing we can do about it. Actually, you know, as we've been preparing for this podcast, I've of course been thinking a lot about self-compassion. And, you know, I was working with someone the other day who's in this situation that they just really can't control and they're trying to. And so they're beating themselves up because they want to be exerting more control over changing dynamics in their family. And there's really nothing they can do about it, you know? And sometimes the first step to acceptance is just practicing saying to yourself, like, this situation is terrible. I'm really suffering, you know? There's nothing I can do about this. And it is really terrible. And so now I need to work on accepting it.
That's really interesting that it's almost like trying to control a situation that you don't have control over is a way to feel, it's a way to feel more in control. It's a way to feel like you're not helpless. And it's probably a way to avoid some of those feelings of pain of being stuck in a situation and feeling a little like helpless too. Like there's not much you can do about this dynamic in your family. And that's a very difficult thing to sit with, especially without self-compassion.
And I think again, the reason that the patient was trying to control it was because, you know, that feels better, right? Thinking that you have control over a situation makes you feel more in control, right? It's really tough to acknowledge that there's nothing you can do sometimes.
Right. Well, it makes you feel better in the moment.
In the moment.
Like for a second, if you're thinking like, okay, maybe I could do this, maybe in your problem solving, maybe that makes you feel a little better in the moment. But then when you take a step back and, or later on realize that like those, you're trying these strategies, nothing's working, that might make you actually feel worse. And so practicing self-compassion, it's almost like there's self-compassion is overlaps. I'm picturing like a Venn diagram with acceptance.
Yes. So let's kind of go through step by step how to practice self-compassion. We've talked a lot about why it's helpful, what gets in the way of it. Let's talk about how to do it in the moment. Let's kind of teach the skill. So that, you know, our listeners can notice when it's needed, practice it, and hopefully see the benefits that we've talked about, including, you know, actually being able to acknowledge mistakes and connecting with other people and, you know, sort of effectively managing situations and accepting situations that you can't control. So let's kind of take a step-by-step approach.
So the first step is acknowledging, having a willingness to acknowledge that what is happening right now is what is happening right now. So like to acknowledge, like with your client, like this is a moment of suffering. This is a really, really difficult thing that I'm going through. This is really hard right now. And I think the reason that that is an important first step in practicing self-compassion is that you can't really be compassionate until you first acknowledge that there is suffering. Just like if your friend called you and was like, oh, I need to talk to you about something. There's something really difficult going on in my life. If you're like, nope, don't have time. Sorry, I'm in the middle of things. Like, you're not going to be able to give your friend compassion if you can't first just sit there and acknowledge that they're going through something, that this is really hard.
Yeah. And, you know, as you were just talking about the overlap between self-compassion and acceptance, that's practicing acceptance.
This is what's happening right now. And I'm not going to try to fight it or control it artificially by ruminating and beating myself up and all those other behaviors that are a way to avoid these feelings. Actually just acknowledging and accepting. Yep. This is a moment of suffering.
Yeah. And then I think the next step is zooming out and saying to yourself, suffering is part of the human experience. Everyone suffers. This is the moment that I'm suffering, right? Which is the opposite of a lot of times what we do to ourselves when we say, oh, you shouldn't be suffering so much, right? You should be enjoying this moment. You know, you should have done better. it's really radical acceptance of the suffering of what you're going through.
And I think a lot of times suffering can feel really isolating. Like you can feel like you're the only person who's ever felt this way, or, you know, no one knows what it feels like to feel the kind of pain that you're feeling in that moment. And people don't always talk about the pain that they're in. So maybe you've never heard somebody talking about the type of pain that you're in. Mm-hmm. So even if you don't personally know somebody who's gone through what you're going through, just to acknowledge that humans are imperfect. Humans make mistakes. Suffering is universal. Suffering is part of life. That piece of it, I think, helps you connect to other people in a way that makes you feel much less alone.
And be a step towards self-forgiveness too, right? Like everyone makes mistakes. And I am one of those people in this moment who made a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that step, I mean, all of the steps of self-compassion, I think, are necessary. But that's usually the moment at which I notice a shift in how I'm feeling when I practice that second step.
When you say like everyone makes mistakes and I am someone who just made one. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think that kind of removes like a heaviness, you know, mm-hmm. It kind of can free you to actually do something about it is kind of what we're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And like holding yourself up to unrealistic standards of perfection, it's a losing battle. Like nobody is perfect.
Yeah. I think the last step is kind of what we have been talking about in terms of being your own best friend, that kindness, practicing kindness toward yourself. Even just saying out loud, like, may I be kind to myself in this moment?
Mm-hmm. Can I offer myself compassion? This makes me think of the self-soothe DBT skill. Like maybe even asking yourself, like, what do I need right now to care for myself? I know that I did that in that example I was giving earlier about the situation with my client giving me that feedback. Like when part of my practice of self-compassion that evening was like, what do I need right now to show myself compassion, show myself kindness, rather than punish myself, which is what I otherwise would have done. Like, you know, have a miserable night. Like, no, what do I actually need right now to be kind to myself?
And what did you do? How did you practice kindness toward yourself?
I took a bath.
Ooh.
Which was lovely. I lit some candles. I put music on. I played with my dogs.
Mm.
I watched a TV show that I had been excited to watch.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. A lot of self-care.
What a radical approach. And I bet that taking care of yourself made you much better rested to deal with the problem the next day than if you had stayed up all night ruminating, beating yourself up, right? Yes. I mean, think about that physically. Think about like those two different options. In the ruminating, staying up all night, you probably come to work the next day like bleary-eyed, you know,
exhausted,
in a bad mood, like
burnt out,
not practicing your interpersonal effectiveness skills, right? Whereas if you actually take the time to take care of yourself, show kindness toward yourself, you're just in a better place to actually solve the problem.
I totally agree. And something I noticed is that, like, you know, my mind wasn't quite ready to let that situation go. Like I needed to think about it a little bit more, but the way that I went about, like when I was taking a bath, I was still thinking about the situation, but the way that I was talking to myself in my head was so much more productive and so much more helpful than it would have been if I hadn't been practicing compassion. So like, instead of being like, you're a terrible therapist, and just criticizing and beating myself up, which is not productive, like I'm not learning anything from that. Yeah. I was able to say like, it's okay. Like, you know, everybody makes mistakes, you know, you can learn from this. What can you learn from this? How can you move forward? What can you maybe do next time? And not in a mean way, but just in a, like, almost like a, like you were saying before, like a problem solving type way, while still kind of like the way that if your friend made a mistake, you'd be like, okay, like, no big deal. Mistakes happen. You know, it's okay. I've done that before. You've done that. Everybody's done things before that they wish that they hadn't. what can we learn from this? Like, how can we take this lesson and move forward in life? And that was much more helpful.
You know, it kind of reminds me of like the fundamental dialectic in DBT. We're doing the best we can and we need to do better, right?
Mm, yes. That is exactly what we're talking about.
Saying to yourself, you're doing the best you can. It's okay to make mistakes sometimes and you can do better. So how do we learn from this? How do we move on? How do we improve? Is a much more effective approach.
One of the aspects of self-compassion is using compassionate touch, which is something that some people like and some people feel it's kind of odd. So some people might feel like a little bit uncomfortable with that, which uh-huh. I totally get. Uh-huh. I actually find it to be really, really helpful. It just kind of like soothes your nervous system. If you like put a hand on your chest, like one hand on your chest, one hand on your stomach, or some people like to just like touch, like hold their cheeks, kind of like the way that you like hold a little kid's cheeks, just like tuck your face. We're both doing it right now. This feels kind of good.
Yeah. You know, when you say it, it makes me feel like it's something that I might find uncomfortable. And then I just did it and it made me feel great.
It's an opposite action that you can try, right? Like, you, when you feel like you did something wrong or you feel like you failed, maybe your instinct is to physically hurt yourself. Maybe your instinct is to self-harm or pull your hair, or pick your skin, or, you know, eat foods that aren't going to make you feel good. Compassionate touch is an opposite action to that. It's how can I actually like put my hand on my heart, hold myself like a friend. And it's kind of like, it kind of reminds me of like the willingness skills of like willing hands, how positioning your body in a certain way to almost signals to your mind that you are open and you are willing and you're compassionate.
Yeah.
In this episode, we're talking about self-compassion, the idea that we can suffer with ourselves. We can be there for ourselves like a friend. And that one of the biggest barriers to practicing self-compassion is feeling like we need to beat ourselves up in order to meet our goals. And that's, we're going to not be as, you know, we're not going to be able to improve in the ways that we would like to if we aren't unkind to ourselves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we've alluded to kind of throughout this episode how beating ourselves up works a lot like corporal punishment, where like in the short term, yes, maybe there's some compliance. Maybe if you beat yourself up, you will whip into shape in that moment. But there's a lot of long-term consequences of doing that, including like increasing anxiety, increasing shame. And then we've talked about how that really shuts down your ability to learn and grow from experiences that you may have had.
And actually reach out and connect with other people in a productive way.
Yes. Yes. And so it also helps to improve relationships with yourself and with other people. And yeah, and then just to review those steps of self-compassion. First step, this is a moment of suffering. So just acknowledging and accepting that you are suffering right now. Second step is acknowledging that everybody suffers, that suffering is universal and it's part of the human experience. And then the third step is, you know, allowing yourself to be kind to yourself, saying something to yourself like, may I be kind to myself? May I be compassionate to myself? Giving that compassionate touch, practicing the self-soothe DBT skill, any of those types of skills.
And then maybe using opposite action to reach out, to stop hiding, to actually engage in problem solving.
Beautiful. I love it.
All right. Well, we hope that this is a skill that you can practice, that you can take with you, that will improve relationships. And we know that we've been practicing it and it's actually been, we've both been seeing concrete results. So we hope that you will continue to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Therapists in the Wild, on Twitter at Therapists Wild. And again, please email us with any feedback, therapistsinthewild@gmail.com. And until next month, stay skillful, everyone.